In the fireside room this morning, Gaylord Thomas continues his study on what we have left done and what we have left undone. Today's topic is Where's the Church? You would be surprised. This is session THG 2000-3. Let's listen in.
My name is Gaylord Thomas, and I work for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I work with the Domestic Hunger Fund Community Development Services. And today, I've been talking along the sides, around the periphery all weekend, telling stories and stuff. And people say, well, you need to talk about that. You need to tell people about that. So I don't want this to sound like an ego trip or anything. But today we're going to just talk about stories. And I'm going to talk about some places that you ordinarily wouldn't think the Lutheran Church would be. The first story I want to tell you about is that on May 14th, I was part of a 13-person delegation of religious people from the international arena that had the opportunity to be international observers in Haiti for the election, the local elections that they held, which is just an overwhelming experience. And so I just want to briefly just talk about that and the complexity of it. And the reason is because I want to encourage more folks to be involved. Haiti is an island 46 miles off the tip of Cuba. It's the first black republic on the planet and the second republic in the Western Hemisphere, 1803. But for many years, most of the peasants in Haiti feel like their struggle, their demise, has been caused because they defeated Napoleon. And they think that the rest of the world is punishing them for that. So I could talk for hours, probably days, on the complexity of problems in Haiti. But the reality of it is that there's 7 million people in Haiti, close to 8 million. They occupy one-third of the island of Hispaniola, the other third is the Dominican Republics. 30% literacy, which is incredible. 7 out of 10 of the people can't read or write. 97% of the island is black. A lot of folks don't know when Columbus landed, the Arawak Indians occupied the island. And Encyclopedia Carter estimates that there was 100,000 Arawak Indians there, that Columbus had them kneel down and pray and cut all their hands off. So the entire population of the indigenous people was wiped out. And so after the rebellion, the French left, the island's pretty much an all-black island. And so I come back home back in October, my first visit, and I told folks, if you want to get the flavor of Africa, you don't have to go to Africa, you can go to Haiti for much cheaper. Because it still retains a lot of culture and a lot of lifestyle in Africa. But anyway, in Haiti, it's divided up into 9 departments, which are equivalent to states. And in September, they start an election registration process. And they registered 4.3 million people and produced these ID cards. And everybody was just couldn't believe that. And then we found out that a lot of the excitement and a lot of the enthusiasm about registration was because people didn't have any papers. They don't have birth certificates, they don't have identification. And so a lot of folks are just excited about having an ID card with a picture on it. So what they did was, the way they designed this thing was, they created a central board of an election called the CEP, C-E-P, and a 9-body member governed this particular organization. And the country is divided into 9 departments, would be close to what we call states. And because of the literacy rate in Haiti, it's a very complicated process. Matter of fact, in October when I was down there, I was asking a guy, I said, well, if 7 out of 10 of the people can't read or write, how are you going to have an election? How are people going to read the ballots? And he said, well, we have symbols for party, don't you? I said, wow, yeah, we got a donkey and an elephant, right? So with that, I just want to pass around. This is a sample ballot that was used. There was 5 different offices. This is the Senate office, and there was 2 seats open. And the reason I have this ballot, this particular person voted for 3, so they threw this ballot out. But there's a face, and not only is a face, but there's a symbol for the party. And so these are the visuals that would help people to understand who they're voting for. And it's very interesting. I was telling somebody just to tell you how complicated things were and the literacy was. I observed one guy take the ballot and make a line through the circle like this, and then turn the paper and make the other side that. I mean, he was just that uncomfortable with putting an X on the paper. But anyway, so they divide the country up in these 9 departments, and they create these sub-areas, which are called BECs. And there was 13 BECs, one supposedly in each of the 9 departments, and two in 2 of the other large areas. In Port-au-Prince, the main city, had 2 BECs, and then one of the other cities had 2 BECs. And we went through a 2-day training. OAS sponsored the training. We went through, this is one of the manuals that we use, and the other manuals, a lot thicker, that gave us a little political orientation to the country and the reality, a background on the parties. There was 206 international observers. There was 11,295 polling places in the country, because the maximum amount of people that could vote was 400 at these polling places. And that doesn't sound like a lot to you all who come from more sophisticated democratic processes. But you gotta understand, some of these little polling places were 8 by 10 rooms with dirt floors, cinder block walls, and tin roofs. Very hot, very humid. There's 4 members in the election process on the election board that manage each of the polling places. And then any of the parties can send representatives in. And then they wanted 4 national observers, local people, for each one of these polling places. And so they wanted 44,000 local observers to monitor these 11,000 sites. They ended up with about 21,000 actual local observers. But the real task, they really relied on the international observers to really sanction this election. And I thought that was a tremendous task for just 206 of us. I was paired with a young lady from Germany named Veronica Hintz, who had done the election in Mozambique and also in South Africa, and she spoke 5 languages. And we covered 30 polling places. We had 331 polling places that was in our particular area, and we were able to cover 30 of them. Security was extremely, extremely important. Matter of fact, they issued us a radio. A team got a radio. We got a cell phone apiece. There was a radio in the van, a Haitian driver. We all got 4-wheel drive vehicles, and then we got these survival kits with umbrellas, water, flashlights, and candles. And then we were deployed out throughout the countryside, and we stayed out there 4 or 5 days. Because the process in these countries that have just started to attempt to have democracies, the voting is done and the counting is done all together. So it's assumed the polls open at 6 to 6, and then you stay right there and count throughout the night. And if you can't finish it, the president of the voting poll has to take the ballots home and sleep on them, because security is a tremendous issue. One of the closing comments in the training, the guy said he was trying to give us the location of the UN fuel dump so we could gas our vehicle up. And we had made a test run out to our area and looked around. We realized that it was just 40 kilometers out of where we had to go. And we had a diesel vehicle. And I said, oh man, we're not going to burn near enough gas out of this vehicle to be worried. And he said, well, maybe so, but just in case, don't let your tank get below half, because if something jumps off, you got to drive to the Dominican border over the mountain. And we looked at each other and said, ooh. But security was, throughout the introduction and orientation, security was an issue, because Haiti has had its problems, tremendous problems. There was probably 17, 18 people killed there. Probably the worst incident, during this election, probably the worst incident was they stoned a guy about 100 feet from the U.S. Embassy, and nobody even cared. There's no investigation or anything. He laid there 2 hours dead before anybody moved him off the street. But it's just that type of madness that occurs in Haiti. But anyway, of the 13 international observers from the religious community, and these observers were sponsored by the Lutheran World Federation. 9 of them were French, 1 Swiss, 2 Germans, and myself from the United States. And obviously I had tremendous language difficulties. I only speak English and not that well. It was difficult. But there's another reality. There's some other things that one can do. So if any of you ever consider this, don't let language be a barrier to you, because there's some things that you can do in this process. I was the radio person. I was able to communicate through ID cards and a number of other things, and the lady I was with actually did the talking. But the experience was overwhelming. It was tense at times. But anyway, our final analysis of this whole piece was that in our report, we broke it down into 2 phases, and we felt that the election process itself, that the majority of people really attempted to participate in this process with an amount of integrity and commitment. There was people who left home probably 3-4 o'clock in the morning, came down out the mountains, walked for 50-60 kilometers just to get there, or ride donkeys, and stood in front of the polling place 1.5 hours just to vote. And I'm sure in the United States, if we had those obstacles, a whole lot of folks wouldn't even get up and come out to the polls. They had about a 68% turnout, which was great numbers. So in our observation, we said that it appeared that the majority of people attempted to do this and do this right with a sense of integrity. However, in the counting process, we observed enough irregularities and inconsistencies that we couldn't sanction the election. And so what happened was, and the fear was that the ruling party, Fermi Lavalas, had $11 million involved in it. They were able to pay people and a number of other things. But what happened was fatigue and the other obstacles just fed into the process so much that it just disrupted it. For instance, we stayed in the polling place that we decided to observe the count in. We got there about 5:15, and we stayed till about 2 in the morning. And the reason that they had to interrupt the count stop is because the candles burned out. I mean, we were in there with 3 candles. There was about 12 was in there looking at these ballots, and there's 5 different ballots that they had to count and observe. And just the first process is to throw out those that aren't valid because it either didn't check anybody or checked too many or whatever. And then they count them, and it's by candlelight. People are tired. They've been up since 4 in the morning, and it's 2. I was in there nodding off. So we interrupted the count, and that morning we went back at 5, and they finished the count. And then what we do is we escort the voting personnel to the BEC, which is the place where it accumulates the votes. When some places people were just so tired and frustrated that they just couldn't continue the process. And they just threw the ballots in the backs, and just there were ballots thrown all over the places. We observed places with just ballots, tons of ballots just stacked up. We went one place and we walked in, and the floor was about 6 foot high full of ballots. We went up on the second floor like on the balcony, and just full of ballots, and they were wet. So there was no way to validate or to confirm anything if it was challenged in it, and that bothered us. But the ruling party was going to win anyway, because if we threw the election out, they didn't want it anyway because they were already in power. And if we sanctioned the election, they hadn't won it. So either way, they would win. And so it's even more complicated now, because the opposition party and the people's movement they've been discouraged and demoralized. And the third day of the counting process, you saw less and less opposition people trying to observe the counting process. The other thing that's very important is that other than the 13 observers sponsored by the Lutheran World Federation, all the rest of the observers, most of which came from bilaterals, U.S. bilateral, French bilateral, Spanish bilateral, Canadian bilateral, It's a different type of person. It's a different type of being. They don't have the same conviction and commitment to the people as us church folks, so to speak, have. They came in like power. They came in dictating. They came in with a very controlling, paternalistic attitude. And so in one of our recommendations, we said was that we need to be very diligent and aggressive in encouraging, recruiting more people from the religious community to be a part of this process. There's an election occurring almost every month somewhere. This election was Sunday, May 21st. On the 16th of May, right across the mountain, the Dominican Republic was an election. I think Peru or Paraguay was 2 weeks later. In all these circumstances, there's observers, and the church plays a strong role in that. And so those of you that would want some international experience, I encourage you to look into these things and think about them, because it's extremely important. And the people really want you there. They do not really treat you like you're an outsider, putting your nose in some business you don't belong in. They really welcome you there, because they know you're coming as a neutral body and that you're the only hope to bring in some fairness to this election.
How would you look into it, as you say?
Well,
how could somebody in this room participate?
Well, the first thing is, if you go on the internet and get into the UN, however that is, you go into UNDP, United Nations Development Projects, and you look at hotlines. And that's the first area that you can look at. Those are openings for volunteer opportunities and long-term mission assignments. And then the second thing, if you can go on the internet and look for OAS, and I don't know what the actual address is, but get into OAS, and they'll tell you there's a whole division in Washington, D.C. that don't do anything called the civil society process. And they list the elections. The other thing is go through your church. You know, go through the church. Call the Division of Global Mission of Evangelical Lutheran Church and talk to somebody there. And I can't say specifically who it is, because the way that division is divided, they have area secretaries for different regions. So, for instance, the Latin American Caribbean secretary is Rafael Malpica. And so he would be aware of all of those elections that occur in that particular region. It's one of those experiences that changes your life. You know, it's a 14-15 day commitment, and it's real work. You know, I mean, you stay out there 4 or 5 days long after the election. We observed a whole lot of things happening, but it was a rewarding experience. Are there any questions on that? I'm gonna tell three different sets of stories about where the church is and what they need to do. And through this whole process of today, if any questions, just stop me where I am and I'll talk. The other piece that I want to talk about, place where you normally don't think the church is in 1996 in March, a group of denominational folks got together in Knoxville, Tennessee after visiting the church that Reggie White attended, you might have heard of, that got burned down in Knoxville, Tennessee. We visited a church, had a press conference, and sat down and we mapped out a strategy on how we're going to wake the nation up to this issue of these churches being burned in the South. Most of them African American, about 96% of them African American churches throughout the South. And so we mapped out a strategy, and unfortunately, a couple of people in there asked the bishop of the ELCA to second me to the National Council of Churches to be the lead organizer. I really didn't know what I was getting into, but you just thought, yeah, go for it. But my task was to go around to these churches in the South and visit with them face to face, build these relationships, and encourage them to come to Washington in June when we have this big national event. Two things happened that I think are important for us to know. That was in March. When April, Ralph Reed got hold of this. Everybody know who Ralph Reed is?
Yeah, no.
Christian Coalition. Was he the executive director of the Christian Coalition? He got hold of it, and he was going to make it an issue. So what he did was he sent $5,000 out to maybe 20 or 30 of these churches. At the time, the catchment of churches was about 48 that we knew about that had been burned. And He sent the $5,000 out and asked them to come to the press club in May or April for a big press conference. He got two pastors came. And I think that's a lesson for us to learn about the old-fashioned way of building relationships and one-on-ones. Mm-hmm. You know, myself and others, we were actually on-site, sitting in kitchens, eating sweet potato pie, collard greens, clapping and hollering in church with them. And so we had relationships mm-hmm. built. So when we called the conference in June, we got all of them. All of them came. We came to Washington, D.C. There was 48 pastors, representatives from 48 different institutions that came. We met with President Clinton, Janet Reno, Jerry Rubin from Treasury, just a ton of folks. CNN was covering it. But what I think made it a national issue while we were in Washington, D.C., is 13-year-old girl right outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, burned the church down. And so as they showed us going around the Capitol visiting with these folks, the background of this church was being burned. And I think that that is a good example I need to focus on just to tell you the complexity of this problem. She was a 13-year-old white girl, and our particular criteria was it had to be from the result of hate or race. Those were the churches that we were focusing on. And so folks said, well, how could she be racist or how could she have hate? Well, two things. First of all, the church was about 21 miles from her house. 10 gallons of kerosene was used to ignite the church. And there's no rapid transit system that goes to the church. And so when the FBI and ATF investigators, they were talking to the girl, and they found out what the conversations were around the dinner table. And of course, you know what type of language they're using around the dinner table, them folks and that. So there was a race and hate connection. But the piece that really bothers us, she didn't do it alone. Mm-hmm. You know, and nobody else surfaced. Mm-hmm. It's just a ton of stories. I think probably Bologna, Alabama, and Jackson, Tennessee were the two areas that were probably the most scary for me. In Bologna, Alabama, they burned four churches, a barn, and shot into a pickup the same night, all the same night. And when they arrested the people that did it, they said that, it wasn't anything about burning a black church down. We just got drunk and decided to burn a church down. And you could almost buy that argument until you go down there. You know, these black churches are, you know, off the main highway, two-lane highway, gravel, dirt, and then back up in the woods, you know. And you could pass the Presbyterian Church and the First Baptist Church. So they had to make an effort to find these very remote churches. Stories like that all over the place. Fortunately, God willing, there was only one rumor of a body that we found in one of the churches in South Carolina. One of the scariest of events for me that troubled me the most, and I'm still struggling with it, was Greensburg, South Carolina. It was a church burned. Reverend Bobby Hankerson was the pastor. And they arrested three youth that burned this church, and one of them was 15 years old. And he had been arraigned and released on bail. And so he called the pastor. And the pastor wasn't there, but you know, somehow these answer machines misfunctioned. I mean, the pastor was there. Somehow these machines misfunctioned, and when you pick it up, the tape's still running. And so we actually had the tape when we got there a month later. We had the tape and heard this young boy. And he was crying, he was very emotional, and you could tell he was recruited into this organization against his will. There was no father in the home, the mother had a drinking problem. So he had the same characteristics that we normally associate with some of our urban youth coming out of barrios and ghettos in our big cities. And he was crying. He said, you see, you don't understand. I didn't have any choice in this matter. I go to the Williamsburg County High School, and I belong to an organization that goes up under the SS. We follow this guy named Adolf, and we stand 448 strong. And in a neighboring high school, we're 228 strong. And so it was very troubling to find there's white males in these rural communities that have fallen prey, just like the youth in our inner cities with the lack of positive alternatives. They've fallen prey to these right-wing organizations that come with a doctrine and initiation that give the appearance of support and unity. And they've fallen prey to that. Of The first phase of the Burn Church Project, we had a catchment of about 176 churches or so. About 150 of them were confirmed from the result of race and hate. Some of them were questionable. Was it a drunk or was it somebody on drugs or accidental? The optimum person that was arrested or indicted was a 19-year-old white male from a dysfunctional home. They were being used as pawns, they were being duped. In Jackson, Tennessee, it was a 19-year-old, a 17-year-old, and a 41-year-old man. So when we get to court, we brought the deposition to court. Get to court, the state's attorney asked the guy, well, do you belong to any organization? And the guy said, yeah, I belong to the Ku Klux Klan, and took his wild out and said, I'm paid up in full and I'm proud of it. His attorney was trying to say, sit down, fool. You know, he just ran around court. He was proud of that, you know, so that it was that sense of individuals that burned these churches. And a lot of times they just didn't burn the churches. I mean, they would defecate on the altars and go out, and you know, these little small rural churches traditionally had a graveyard right by them. And they would go out and knock over the gravestones and just all types of stuff. And it was real frightening, you know, because you think the South has changed, you know, in a lot of cases it really hasn't. There's a lot of things happening. Another very scary incident that occurred was in Greene County, Alabama, the county where the Bologie is. There happened to be an African-American judge, and he tried the individual, and he didn't give the harshest sentence available to him. He gave up the middle medium sentence. And just before that, he had also ruled with a class action suit against a plastics company, which was one of the largest settlements in that area. But anyway, two nights after that, he was at home in the evening, and they shot into his house, shot into his son's room, and shot into the living room. And just by God's grace, the son slept in the front room on a sleeping bag with his friend and wasn't in the bed because they blasted the bed up. Mm-hmm. So he reported the crime to the local authorities. Now, this is a judge, educated, or born and raised in Alabama, went to the University of Alabama, Tuscaloosa, went to law school. So he was a homeboy. The sheriff and the state police concocted this story that it was the result of this love triangle, and it was a African-American state trooper that shot because of this love triangle, and they created this fictitious female. They never did produce a name. And so, you know, by the time the dust settled, they just thought that this was an internal squabble. But, I mean, those were the types of things that we ran into throughout. But we ended up building about 87 of those 130 or 40 churches that we confirmed in that first catchment. And we had a big celebration in Washington, D.C. and celebrated, brought the pastors together to participate. And we said we had done a good job. And Lenore Helmsley got out of jail and gave us $2 million more to rebuild some churches. So we started all over again. And we had a whole nother list of churches that we had to review. And all of them were African American. I was telling somebody the other night, another sad story is in Wautumpka, Iowa. There's I don't know if it's right in Wautumpka or on the periphery, there's a big IBP plant. And there's a lot of migrant workers that come up to work in this plant. And there's a ministry being done there by a pastor who's a Vietnam veteran, he's a white pastor. And they had burned his church probably 6 months before that, and he got it rebuilt, and they burned it again. Mm-hmm. And so he came to us, and he didn't want a church, he wanted a dome. There was an organization in Connecticut that was donating these domes. It's an 8-year life, the air conditioned, you can heat them. They're really workable domes, but he was just so uncommon, he just didn't want to go through the process of bringing resources together, building a church, and then it burned in 30 days. Mm-hmm. The other side of it is that the outpouring of support that came from the country was overwhelming, and I think that's where the sense of hope was. International papers stepped up and said, we'll donate all the wood for churches. organs were donated, just a lot of things were donated. But it complicated the issue too, because people in different places were calling and trying to donate things and becoming very frustrated. And finally, a few of us finally had to stand up and say, look, you gotta understand, these churches in the South have pastors that work a regular job all day and pastor on Sunday. Not only do they don't have the ability to accept the facts, a lot of them don't even have phones in this church. And only maybe one day a week is anybody gonna answer that phone. So, you know, you gotta be patient with these folks. Bologna, Alabama, the Mennonite Central Committee came down and set their trailer up and started building one of the churches. And the third day down there, two buses rolled in from San Francisco and about 110 youth flood off these buses coming to build. But you gotta understand, there's not even a public washroom within 35 miles of Bologna. No motels. I mean, we finally worked it out where in the fire station we set up a portable shower for them. But I mean, here these youth there and you're saying, ooh, I mean, it became more complex to coordinate the volunteer process in some cases. I remember in Boston, there was a number of synagogues that were either rebuilding or remodeling. And so the rabbis would call and say, look, I got pews. I got them on the truck. Tell me where to send them. Tell me where to send them. I said, slow down. So now we got to get them out of here. Well, you know, look, you got to say, I've got 40-foot pews and these churches 25 feet wide. You know, what are we going to do? So it was really complex, but you couldn't, you know, you had to sort of flow with it. But I think the significant learning of that experience was, I do work with the Lutheran Disaster Response Team. And so I meet people that volunteer all the time. But I think the uniqueness of this was, in disaster situations, everybody's life is disturbed. And so everybody is in a different state of being. And so they're not in their normal life pattern. We're in the situation of these burned churches, nothing has changed in the community. It's only the church that is burned. So you come in and assimilate into that normal life of that community, which is a little bit different. And so about 6 months into the rebuilding process, the Presbyterian pastor designed this study circle. Somebody mentioned it the other night. This study process, so 2 days out the week, the local people and the volunteers would sit down and start to talk and exchange things. You know, and they would start with the question is, well, how'd you get here? You know, how'd you happen to be in the South? You know, migration patterns, or what'd your grandfather do? Who was sharecroppers? And those from the outside would share their stories. And then there'd be some prayer and song. So the relationship building was just overwhelming. And I know that'll have tremendous rippling effects as time goes on from that experience of the burned churches. But the other scary thing was that our criteria was from the result of race and hate. And each place we went, every month we would get a report from the FBI on churches being burned. And I remember when we got to Portland, Oregon, we were investigating two churches in Portland, Oregon. But the FBI report had 37 to 39 religious institutions that were burned. All of them weren't from hate or race, but they were burned or either vandalized. And everywhere we went, by the time my involvement was finished with this process, our list was about 375, almost 400 churches. The FBI list was 600 churches in this period of time. We're talking about from 1994 to about 1998. So there's a whole reality of religious institutions being burned across this country that the world is not aware of. Every day, you know, there's these churches being burned. The other part of this problem that we really haven't gotten to is that we know the burning of the churches and the individual burning the church is just the top layer of the problem. The other problem is that there's communities in total denial. You know, a community of 400 or 500 people and there's only one gas station in town, somebody rolls in with a pickup. In Knoxville, Tennessee, they took 15 5-gallon cans of kerosene were used on this church. And it happened to be on the day of the largest snow in Knoxville. So there's tracks and everything out there, but nobody saw anything. And so we thought that if we could go back and create these dialogues, these town hall meetings to get folks to talking, we would start to make some progress. And we did do that in some areas, but we weren't successful in all. The other victory, I think, was that the people received us openly. I mean, when I went to the National Council and I was trying to tell folks, trying to give them an idea of where they were going, you know, I said, you can't go down there with your northern stereotypes and da-da-da-da-da, your fast-moving ways, that New York minute type of thing. You got to slow down and work at a Mississippi pace. And they said, yeah, yeah. So I remember the first crew I took out, I had an engineer, I had a loan officer from National Bank, a volunteer coordinator from Habitat Humanities, a construction consultant, a writer, and myself. We're driving down the road. We left Columbia, South Carolina, and we're going to this place called Estelle. There was a federal penitentiary there, and two churches had been burned, and they burned the pastor's house down. And they're just rolling down the road, cracking these all-color jokes and just laughing and joking. And I told him, I said, well, you know, I just need to tell you all that for the last 20, 30 minutes, this pickup truck's been following us down the road. And we made three turns, and they made three turns. Everybody got silent, and that was it. The whole seriousness of this process turned around. It was an experience that, I mean, it's one of those experiences you don't really want to go back through again, but you wouldn't give $1 million for, you know, you wouldn't sell it for $1 million. The significant thing was when we started out with this process, we weren't there yet, you know, so it was a great deal of risk. So I had ran my ELCA credit card up to about $39,000, and my total travel budget is less than 10. So, but the point I'm saying is, the church supported that and knew that, and so I think, I mean, it was, I think that's a proud statement for the Lutheran Church that they stepped out there and took that risk, because there was really only one Lutheran church burned. And it wasn't burned from the same criteria. It was burned in San Jose, California. And really, I got angry with that pastor because he wanted the wood from International Paper. And I said, look, I mean, you don't fit our criteria. It was an insured church, you know. And then later on, I found out that Mission Investment Fund even held the paper. So I went on vacation and He called the National Council, and they just felt sort of beholden to the Lutherans, so they agreed to fund the guy. And so when he called the International Paper Company, he told, you know, the International Paper guy, after about 2 weeks, was just so frustrated. He said, look, this guy's ridiculous, you know, I mean, he wants teak in certain places, and rosewood in certain places, you know. That particular church was burned by an alcoholic. They burned the Lutheran church on one street and the Episcopal church next door. So it was sort of in the gray area. But you know, I loved him anyway. But, I mean, I think the church's involvement there, I mean, you don't normally think of the church being involved. It was interesting because we had an opportunity to meet President Clinton in Greeleyville, South Carolina. And I had a few moments to talk with him. And I told him that my commitment to this was that I had found out a year before that, and this was was shocking to me. You know, for most part, the civil rights movement started in December 1955 when Rosa Parks attempted to board the Cleveland Avenue bus in Montgomery, and from there, you know, the boycott. That was 1955. It wasn't until 1965, on the third attempt across the Pettus Bridge from Selma to Montgomery, probably the most famous march in the civil rights movement, that the national churches got on board. And I was shocked. I thought the denominations were involved from day one. But it wasn't until 10 years of the civil rights movement. Now, there were individual pastors and individual congregations and individual volunteers involved in it from the start, but denominations didn't sanction it until the Unitarian pastor James Reed got beat to death, and he was on national TV, and in the third temp across the bridge, seven nuns flew down and actually led the march. They left Brown Chapel with about 3,000 people, and halfway through, it was a two-day march, halfway through the march, when they got to Montgomery, it was 25,000 people. You know, every denomination in the world sent representatives down. So I told President Clinton, I said, my task, and I think in this whole piece, is to guarantee that if this is going to be a movement in this country, that the mainline denominations are aboard from beginning to end. And we had that commitment across the board. It was a tremendous victory in ecumenism. We talk about ecumenism, which happens to be a Christian term, so you immediately exclude the Muslims and Jews when you use that term. And in a lot of our ecumenical circles, you don't have Jewish or Muslim participants or Catholics. But in this movement, we had everybody across the board. Latter-day Saints, Promise Keepers, the far-right evangelicals, everybody came. Maybe for the wrong reasons, but we were all there attempting to help these churches rebuild.
Were there synagogues also that were burned?
Well, there was two. One in Richmond that was vandalized, and then one in, I'm drawing a senior moment here, I think in North Carolina, that they attempted to burn and they caught it before it burned down. Those were the only two we had documented.
Any mosques?
No mosques. One of the more sad times was, we after a while in the rebuilding process, we realized to make this a more efficient process, we need to set up these regional visits where they would come in and fill out these evaluations, and we'd figure out how to help them with loans, grants, or whatever. And so we set one up in Montgomery, Alabama, and we had 10 or 12 churches come. Well, a Hare Krishna barn was burned in right outside of Gulfport, Mississippi. And this guy came in, he brought us flowers, he brought the Bible, he had some of these organic cookies, and I mean, he just soft-pedaled us to death. And so Sarah and I listened to this story, you know, and we kept telling, this is gonna be a hard sell, you know, because there's some folks up in New York that not with this Hare Krishna thing. And really what happened was, it wasn't their sanctuaries burned, it was their barn. But in that religion, the animals are sacred, you know. But we just couldn't make that connection to the folks in New York. They just wasn't hearing it. You know, you're talking about a barn for animals and not for people. But we really, deep down inside, thought we needed to support that, Sarah and I, but we couldn't. Any other questions?
Are their churches still being burned?
Their church is still being burned. Texas is still extremely hot. Outside of Dallas, a little north of Fort Worth, a whole lot of stuff is happening there. We probably had 10 churches that were burned repeatedly, build it up and reburn again. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, just folks just, and see, the problem with these churches, the thing that complicates it is that, you know, we did these assessments on the churches, and we gave them grants. HUD came in and insured these loans for them and made them very liberal. But the reality is, if your church is burned and down for about 12, 14 months, some of the folks gonna go away and not come back. You know, so you had to take that in consideration. You know how in the Lutheran Church we base it on giving units, and that's how we project the benevolence dollars. But when you do that, you gotta think, well, you know, this congregation went from 300 to 110. You know, you gotta give them time to get the momentum back before they can even generate capital. So there's a whole lot of complicated things involved in this. The other reality is that they were very conservative African-American churches for the most part of, you know. And so that was very difficult for organizations like the National Council to deal with. Some of them even rejected our New Standard Revised Version of the Bible because it makes references to God as she through them. You know, I mean, that's just the conservativeness of these people. The other thing is that then they weren't connected to anybody. I mean, they don't have associations, they don't have Bible groups, you know. They're just independent churches, just out there by themselves. And so this gave them a sense of connectedness, too, to be a part of this process. The other area that I want to take you to that was really virgin water for the United, for the ELCA to participate in. And I need to say this up front. Whoever the young man was that filmed the Rodney King beating ought to be given a Pulitzer Prize, honest to God. I can't even recall his name, it's a shame. Because what he did for a special population of people in this country is incredible. Now, out of that Rodney King thing, there's a whole population of folks that have been invisible. African-American, Latino, street kids caught up in the madness, had not been listened to, and the only people who were reacting to them was the Department of Corrections and Law and Order. And out of that Rodney King experience, that population emerged. Excuse me. And what I mean by that is that in the Lutheran tradition, we had five congregations in and around the South Central LA area that came together to form this organization, the CDC, called New City Parish. And they were in different communities, a Latino, African-American, and white congregation came together out of these five. And so they had a consultation out there, and we brought a couple of companies in that said that they were going to commit to bring jobs into the area to this population of people. And so we had this big, large consultation at the Marriott LAX. We brought these companies in. We had about 75, 80 people in, ELCA staff folks. And it eventually fell apart because some of the people out there were asking the corporation, what's the benefit plan? And their response was Social Security. You know? So some folks just didn't react to that, no medical plan or anything. But out of that experience, there was a number of gang members there. And engaging the gang members, they bought into it. You know, and I thought that was refreshing and rewarding to me because I had written off a generation of youth. Really, I had 15 to 18 years old. I just thought we weren't going to be able to save them. Because I knew for a fact there's young kids on the streets of our big cities making $300-$400 cash money a day in the drug industry. And how are you going to take a 14-year-old kid and get him to work for $6 or $7 an hour on a program after making that money, much money? I didn't know. But what these gangbangers confirmed to me was that they realized that was not longevity, you know, because ain't no gang members of drug dealers in senior citizen homes, and they realized that. And so they said to me, they said, look, for $7 an hour, we'll work. However, we want 40 hours. You know, McDonald's has got this plan where they only give you 28 hours and they don't have to give you any benefits. They said, we're not going for that game. But if you can create 40-hour jobs for $7 an hour, we can find tons of folks that'll put down that business and work. And that was a revelation. Out of that experience came a gang summit in 1993 in Kansas City. They called it a Peace and Justice, first Peace and Justice Summit, National Peace and Justice Summit of its kind, dubbed the Gang Summit. There was 156 participants. There was 38 observers from denominations. And our assignment was to listen and serve, not to participate or lead. The largest delegation, I really got joy out of telling the folks when I got back to the ELCA about this, the largest and only integrated delegation came from Minneapolis. White and black, they brought a Baptist pastor and a lawyer with them. It was the Vice Lord organization. There was Latinos, both Puerto Rican, Mexican, Native Americans, and African Americans. There was no Asian representatives there. For me, it was probably the most emotional experience I'd ever had in my life. And I was a combat vet from Vietnam. I mean, what happened at that summit was just incredible. At the worship service at the end of this conference, there was two pastors that preached. One preached the prodigal son, and the other one preached out of Revelations about them going up into heaven. And they looked over and they saw these other people going up and said, well, these folks don't look like us. Why are they going into heaven, you know? And they preached these two wonderful sermons. And then at the end of the sermon, the pastor said, I got a call last night. And I want to know if that individual is ready to come forward with what they said they were. And so this individual stepped up on the podium of the church and told his history, that he was a blood in California, and that for the last 2 years he had this assignment to kill somebody. And he said, that individual's here now, and I'd like to call him up. And so, right, and so he took his red bandana off his head, and dropped it. Now, that doesn't sound like nothing to you, but in gang life, that's dropping your flag. That's like a military person taking the United States flag and stepping on it. And the Crip that he was after came up and dropped his flag. And they hugged and cried in front of these 2,000 people. It was a powerful moment. There was a young sister that stood up. They had excluded the women. And there was a young woman stood up there and made this testimony about, I carry your babies, I'm beaten, I carry your dope, you know, and you've excluded me. You're not there when they lay a yellow tape around our kids. She was just so powerful. I got her taped testimony. She was 25 years old. So they had this four-point agenda or focus areas, and they had to create a fifth one called women. Mm-hmm. You know, women of the movement. It was a powerful, powerful thing. There was a moment, there was tension constantly throughout the thing. And the Baptist pastor that they brought from Minneapolis with us, you know, when it got real tense, he was a great singer, he stepped to the mic. You know, precious Lord, you know, amazing grace, and just sing, and it would bring calm in the room. And it was designed like any other conference. We went to the streets, we divided up into four groups, and we went to the juvie facility, they went to a homeless shelter, they went to a rape center for women, and they went somewhere else, and they talked with the people on the street. I mean, this is leadership. These folks, some of them 25, 30 years old, been in the penitentiary a long time, and all of them came together. I mean, wanting to give back. That was their statement. We know we've done a lot. And a lot of them had said that we know we're not going to get to heaven. I mean, that was their mentality. But we want to make a difference before we go. And I mean, it just, I came away from there just pumped up. And I met this pastor in the airport. I had to go to a conference in Tampa. And I was just pumped up. And I told him about these gangbangers. You know, I said, I think this is the first time I've seen the face of Jesus. I mean, these guys called their own peace on the streets. You know, their constituencies, the gang members said, I mean, you know, how are we going to eat? You know, and then the society is rejecting it, but they stood fast. In Los Angeles, the Crips and the Bloods took the Camp David Accord, the actual Camp David Accord, and marked it up and made it work for them. The Latino community, what they call Boyle Heights, East LA, they gathered in Ephesians Park, and they had 1,700 gangbangers out there. And in the Mexican community, the power is in the jail. I mean, whatever's dictated for that population, whatever's dictated in the institution plays out in the streets. And so a guy came with a message from the jail saying that anybody else who participates in a gang-related crime will be treated like a child molester when they get to the joint. They had 19 months of not a bullet being shot. I mean, now there was some internal stuff, but it wasn't a drive-by, it wasn't an innocent grandmother, it wasn't an innocent child killed on the streets. I mean, it was just that much commitment. So I told this pastor about who I'd met and that I was touched. He looked me in the eyes and he said, "You're out of order, and you need to be careful, because you're getting the church involved in something they shouldn't be, because you cannot be certain that they've completely ridden themselves of drugs. There still might be some drugs in and around." And I stepped back and I said, "Oh my God." And I was close to a real state of depression. And 2 weeks after that, this is the way God works. I'm in church and the pastor's talking. And I don't know what the sermon is about. He probably didn't either. And just as a side comment, he said, "And God took this cat that couldn't talk and mumble and who was a murderer." He led the church. I said, "Whoa, I missed that part about Moses. I didn't know that story." But that was the ammunition I needed. If God empowered this murderer, how come we can't embrace these kids who dealt with drugs? But out of that experience, a number of things happened. The 38 observers and denominational people came together and formed this organization called The Things That Make for Peace. It's taken out a verse in Luke. And we worked to support these, and what the Lutheran Church did was we ended up making a loan to an organization in California called Barrios Unidos to help them get a silk screen printing company together to create some economic development. That was 6 years ago. 3 months ago, I went to a grand opening. They had moved from their second location, and they rented the strip mall, and all the operating expenses are now going to be paid by the three tenants, and they got enough space to do what they need to do. And so they're just growing leaps and bounds. That was an interesting experience. When I went out to make the valuation for the possibility of the loan, we met with a number of people in and around Santa Cruz. And so on the third day, they said, we want you to go somewhere with us. And so we stopped by a guy's house, and we got some tiles. And we drove on up to Watsonville and went to this halfway house. And I met with the board of directors. And so then they told me to go in the bathroom and put your swimming trunks on. You got to come with us. Well, I love to swim. That's one of my loves. I'm a lap swimmer. But we go outside, there's no swimming pool. It's this little round hut about this high. And there's a cat burning some stuff out in front. There's a pile of rocks. I don't know what's going on. And so everybody starts crawling in this hole. And they go in there, and they go in and say a little prayer, and they say to all my relations. It's a new experience, man. I didn't know what it was. But this is Indigenous People's Sweat Lodge. They made me sweat in this thing before I could really be a part of this process. I said, the nerve of you, I'm bringing the money, and I got to go through this to give you some money? But, I mean, that's the way they operate it. I mean, that's why they're so successful. I mean, they have a council elders, and they don't move. And so the leader of this organization and I have become just extremely good friends. If we just threw all this other work aside, we'd still be good friends. Because we've both been tested by our particular ethnic groups and our communities for this relationship. But out of this, tremendous relationships have grown. There's a lot of pastors. There's a pastor in San Antonio. If you ever get the opportunity to meet Ann Hemke, she runs the Peace Center. She met a couple of these people right after this gang summit, went back home and left her call, and started working, and she had a gang summit, a San Antonio gang summit, and she's been touched ever since. She's in the streets daily. And when I say you work with gangs, I mean, there's times when you out in the streets, literally between two groups with guns in their hands. I mean, you're mediating. And not only that, you're in the hospitals. I mean, it's real ministry, y'all. Believe me. It's the real deal. Out of that came a number of things. One of the things that the ELCA did was we formed a rites of passage camp for African-American males in 1993. As the media said, the most at-risk individuals in this country were African-American males between the ages of 14 and 21. And so that's where we started, you know. Our idea was to create a program for a whole lot of groups. The unfortunate part of that journey and that experience, it's been 1993 since I've been working, and a group of us have been working in this arena. White America ignored it and thought that they were insulated from this issue. You know, and I was tremendously troubled that white America ignored Kinkle in Oregon. When Kinkle went off and shot his parents and shot into that school, that should have been the signal to America that something's wrong, even in suburbia, in these communities. And we ignored that. And that's why we had a Littleton, you know, because we didn't pay attention to it. And the reason I said they ignored it, because in the early 90s, they had metal detectors in the urban cities, in the barrios and the ghettos. You know, I mean, the security had been picked up. People had been programmed to look for certain things. But in suburban schools, that was ignored. And so now you got all these pieces erupting. And so now they better stop, we better stop real quick and figure out what we need to do. Because we haven't stopped that yet. We haven't addressed that, you know. And everything has been focused at brown and black folks, you know. And it's ethnic specific, a lot of that stuff. And somebody's got to stop and say, hey, we need to create some stuff to address what's happening here. You know, and the other piece of it is coming out of a middle class reality in the white community, where in the other community it comes out from the poverty, from the lower classes. And so we as a church, that's the piece I think we've left undone, and we got to deal with that. And I don't know where we start, because I've been asking questions and trying to get some people motivated to figure out how we do that. The stuff that we use at this camp comes out of Men's Project, that is not really ethnic specific. It just deals with internalized oppression and maleism stuff that we use. There's two models that are used across this country. One is called the man in the box and the woman in the flower, that deals with the stereotypes. And it basically talks about male and female relationships and talks about men crying and showing their emotions. We better figure out a way to reach the population of middle-class suburban males, or it's going to get worse. And so that's the challenge that I lay on you. But out of this particular experience, the church has sponsored this rites of passage camp for what we call more at-risk African-American male kids coming from dysfunctional homes and out of madness. And in August, we will be in our seventh year, and we run this camp in Strawberry Point, Iowa. Matter of fact, the Holden Village alumnus is the director of the camp. His name's Dale Goodman. And he stepped up a couple of years ago and donated his camp for this. And he's taken a beating for it. And so we roll in Strawberry Point, Iowa, with 100 or so gangbangers and 20 or 30 staff folks every year. Strawberry Point is a community of about 350, 400 people, all white, all very rural. And so the first 2 years, it was like we were invisible. I mean, they knew me because I went out every day and spent money. So after 2 or 3 days, they didn't stare at me too much because I was spending money. If you go into the little grocery store in Strawberry Point and spend $300-$400 a day, you know, you're not black no more. You become green. But the community didn't wake up until last year. We had an incident at the camp where a kid ran away. And if you look at camp policy, there's a certain type of liability for a runaway and for somebody that's missing. And so we didn't know what the situation was. So he came up missing early that morning, and we called the sheriff at 8 o'clock that morning. I made the report, and he took the report down and da-da-da-da. And so at 5 o'clock that evening, we didn't find the kid, so now we're panicking. But one of the ladies in the office who lives in Strawberry Point said, well, you need to get the dogs. Well, I was a little hesitant about getting dogs and hunt this kid down. You know, that's part of my stuff, though, I guess. So finally at 5 o'clock, I said, let's get the dogs, you know, whatever we have to do. So I called the sheriff back, and the sheriff told me, he said, listen, all the dogs in the Tri-County area are in Des Moines for dog training. So you're going to have to call the dogs out of Minneapolis, Sneaky Pete, some organization or something. He said, but I got to tell you, it's $500 an hour from the time they board the plane in Minneapolis to the time they leave Iowa. And it's about a minimum of $5,000. And I really struggled with my spirituality, because I hesitated for about an hour. And I said, boy, I'm life and money, I'm holding in the balance, you know. And so finally we said, okay, whatever we have to do, we get these dogs. So I called the sheriff back, and he wasn't available. And now he's real resistant to me. Well, in the meantime, right about the time I talked to the sheriff, 4 pickup trucks come down the road full of teenagers with flashlights and all types of stuff from Strawberry Point. This lady who was in the office was ashamed. When we made the first call that morning, she had been fuming all that day. She said, because there was incidences at that camp for local kids getting lost where the response was totally different. Mm-hmm. They even got the news chopper from Waterloo to go out. And mm-hmm. The sheriff got on. And I it didn't bother me. I guess that's, you know, my response to law and order in the city. But I it didn't touch me, but she was upset. So she went and organized all these people in town. And they swept the area in an hour. They found the kid. Mm-hmm. Well, and so my message is that Strawberry Point is now looking for the Silver Circle to come back. I mean, that's their commitment. They know that these 2-3 weeks, they got these folks coming, and they whatever it has to take to make it happen, it happens. And so, I mean, I think there's some growth in that relationship building, too, and I think that was the victory. because now they know who we are, you know, in a big way, and not just who I am. I'm going to stop right now if there's any questions you want to throw out. I got a short video I want to play for you.
Ministry for At This Voice. Our next story takes you to an ELCA outdoor ministry experience you'll never forget.
Some of them don't believe they don't live in the outdoors. I don't believe it's got different hardcore reactionary creatures. They're different rules. But my prison incarcerated and not
prison. Turn it up.
I've been in this type of system since I was 15. And I won't return home until I'm 19.
Go to the funeral home and go to the emergency room. And you say, really get a dose of what we're talking about.
Creativity, money, and faith.
And we teach those principles to our kids and tell them, and then make them live them.
Who you trying to live? Can you walk?
Another African ceremony involves water. It's a thanksgiving to God for persons who have gone before in life, faith, and the struggle for human rights.
The other ritual we do is morning and libation. The African word for it is San Vito, and that's pouring water on this planet.
Please, stand tall and ready to receive your ancestors.
And what we do is that we're asking for our ancestors. We're calling our personal ancestors. Every one of these kids has got personal friends, they call them out.
They say, don't go when they feel what they don't know. They say, come on to the light. They say, it's not your time. They don't know your time, your place, or how you feel. Maybe you welcome the light.
In order for these children to really be themselves and to be their productive selves, they need to see themselves as they are created, not as something different or something extra or something particularly strange.
Maybe after 2 years of going to this camp, they are tremendously different people. More who they are is now coming to life. Who came to us is not the person that they were. Now the person that we're dealing with now, that's who they really are. The little boy in them comes out. He's scared of worms. You don't want to put the worm on the fish's face. The quietness comes out. The reflection is able to happen. And more who they really are, who God meant for them to be.
Almost every kid goes through some sort of personal transformation, and you see that happening during the process too. Not just tears always, but other types of emotional responses.
It's kind of ironic, but when I see them shed tears, it makes me smile, you know? They're showing their feelings, they're being themselves.
Although he's going to go home and perhaps participate in the same stuff that he's done before he came to camp, there's something in the face that will never be the same again. The stretch of his smile will be a little broader. The deepening of his eyes will grow a little deeper. His hue will be different because something about this camp experience that spiritually engages them in a way that they are profoundly affected for the rest of their lives.
To you, the light may be the only way out. To you, the light may be the only true freedom. Freedom from the darkness. Freedom from your own tears. Freedom from your own fears. They say to walk through the light.
That's a powerful piece. But for some, that reference to the light might be a little confusing.
You know, I think he really means to choose life rather than an early death. And it's just one piece of a lifelong faith journey.
It's really a strong program.
Thank you.